Welcome to the Austin Peay Extras, the podcast series where we share some of the fascinating talks and lectures hosted by the university each semester. In this episode, Joseph L. Graves Jr. talks about what it means to be a human, both biologically and socially, addressing the myths of race and the social construct of racism. This comes from his lecture, Racism, Not Race, A Scientific Approach to the Myth of Race and the Cost of Racism, sponsored by the Diversity Councils of the Erickson College of Education and the College of STEM, the APSU Diversity Committee, and the Office of Equity, Access, and Inclusion.
All right, so racism, not race. Answers to frequently asked questions. I'm giving you the health disparities version of this talk. There are actually many versions of this talk that I and my co-author, Dr. Alan Goodman, who's a former, who is a professor of biological anthropology and former president of the American Association of Anthropologists, have done around the country. So I began to think about why and how people thought racially in our society in the early 1990s. And that led me to the publication of my first book, The Emperor's New Clothes, Biological Theories of Race at the Millennium, which was published in 2001. Now, the purpose of The Emperor was to tell the story of how misconceptions about human biological variation became encoded in American society. And I guarantee that many of you sitting in this audience suffer from these misconceptions right now. Okay, and some of those I'm going to be able to dispel in the course of the few minutes that I have with you. Others, you're probably going to need to read the book and work through, because you know what we found, you know, in Racism, Not Race, and I'll just jump to that because, you know, let's talk. The second book, The Race Myth, came out 3 years later. It was about ongoing pathologies in American society because people continue to believe these false ideas about human biological variation. And I honestly, after writing The Race Myth, I didn't think I'd ever have to write another book about race again, because obviously it was so apparently clear. The science of it was so apparently clear. The history was so apparently clear. But then all of a sudden life happened and the United States literally went stark raving mad. And elected someone into the White House, and a movement began to completely reverse the facts of American history and of modern science. And so my colleague Alan Goodman called me up in 2019. He said, Joe, you know, we really need to write a book again to make this as plain and as simple as possible for folks why so much of these racial ideas are absolute, unadulterated fiction. And that is why we wrote Racism, Not Race, Answers to Frequently Asked Questions. So the purpose of the book is to provide folks with concise, accessible answers to questions about race and racism. Now, these questions were gleaned from our conversations with our students, educators, policymakers, friends, family, church members, okay? Our book is for readers who want to work towards human equity and for people who are nervous about saying the wrong thing. And in many cases, these two groups overlap. Now, if you're in the audience and you're not interested in human equity or justice, okay, this book isn't for you. And by the way, you know, using the words of, you know, past scholars, there are folks who are not interested in equity and justice. And we need to say that up front. But you know, we wrote this because we are interested in those goals. So, over the course of our careers, we found that there's ongoing confusion concerning the meaning and significance of human biological variation, particularly in its relation to things like disease predisposition, which this particular version of the talk is going to address. Okay, now, I've also been doing a lot of work on this, in addition to this book. So, in the New England Journal of Medicine, February of last year, we have a paper, Ongoing Racial Misconceptions in Medical Education. Over the last 2 years, with my colleague, Dr. Andrea Dayrup, who's a professor of pathology at Duke University, we have given over 50 grand round lectures to to leading medical programs in the United States because they are still teaching false science in the form of racial medicine. I spoke at the University of Tennessee's medical school in January of 2023 about this. Okay? This paper, The Myth of the Genetically Sick African, which came out in the journal Genealogy in 2022. This paper, which is now in press, embedded racism, a critical but neglected health determinant in evolutionary medicine, which will come out in the journal Evolution, Medicine, and Public Health in its special issue on health disparities later this year. I will also be giving this address at the National Academy of Sciences, West Coast, in July of 2023. So, chapter one, setting the table. What is race, racism, and human biological variation? Chapter two, how did race come to be, and why is it still so important? Chapter three, everything you wanted to know about genetics and race, and I really do mean everything you ever really wanted to know about genetics and race, can be found in that chapter. Chapter five, why do races differ in disease incidence? Chapter six, life history, aging, and mortality. Chapter seven, athletics, bodies, and abilities. Chapter eight, races, brains, and behaviors. Chapter 10, DNA and ancestry testing. So we provide simple, accessible answers to all of these topics. Now, you will often hear, particularly in diversity, equity, inclusion circles, that race is not a scientific concept. I have actually been quoted by very prestigious publications like the New York Times, like the Los Angeles Times, saying, Dr. Graves says race is not a scientific concept. Nonsense. I have never once said that. Okay? That is a complete and thorough misquote. This is a platitude among scholars in the humanities and the social sciences. It's wrong. There is a biological race concept. Okay? And that biological race concept has developed through time, beginning in Christian theology. And this is one of the things that most people do not know or understand. Biology in the Western world began as part of Christian belief. It was called natural theology in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. And our modern conceptions of race were actually born in those special creationist beliefs about human beings. And I point you to Terence Keel's book, Divine Variations, which was actually stimulated by him reading The Emperor's New Clothes when he was a graduate student at Harvard University. In the 19th century, it moved on to physical attributes of human beings, what we call in genetics the phenotype. It then further developed into the geographical locations in which people lived. And the founders of American science, people like Louis Agassiz, people like Samuel Morton, people like Josiah Nott, George R. Glidden, okay, wrote treatises on how the geographical location as zones of special creation were responsible for the variation that we saw in human beings. It was only in the 20th century, after the unification of natural selection theory with Mendelian genetics, which we call the neo-Darwinian synthesis, does the biological race concept move from special creationism to modern science and becomes based upon the frequency of genes within populations. And then in the 20th century, with the development of phylogenetic techniques, becomes a question of whether any group within a species can be considered a unique evolutionary lineage. So there is a biological race concept. And so when I go around saying to people that our species, anatomically modern humans, does not have biological races, I can say that because there are criteria that we use to determine the existence of races in other biological species. There are plenty of species that have enough adaptation and differentiation between their component populations to be biological races. We just don't happen to be one of them. And so, you know, my mom used to tell me that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I know a lot of social scientists and humanist scholars love to state this platitude. Oh, race is not a scientific concept. Because they don't actually understand the biology. Okay, and what they really mean is that humans don't have biological races, and they're absolutely correct. What we have are socially constructed or socially defined races. These arbitrarily utilize aspects of morphology, what people look like, geography, where they came from, culture, language, religion. But they only do this in the service of social dominance hierarchies. In other words, we entitled our book Racism Not Race because it was racism that created the socially defined groups in hierarchical relations in the Western world. And by the way, these racial ideas spread from the Western world to the rest of the world. They were invented here for the purposes of colonialism, genocide, and slavery. They had only one purpose. That's what they were deployed for, to oppress human beings. They were not the result of an objective examination of the biological variation within our species. That was never part of the process. And so it's important to know the history of ideas to be able to understand what's right about them and what's wrong about them. And we don't do enough of that in science education. I was talking with Philip in the car on the way up here. You know, we present facts. Oh, that's a fact. That's a fact. Well, how did it become a fact? What was the process by which we came to understand this thing to be true? And so when I teach science, I teach the method of science. How do we think? How do we test hypotheses? How do we evaluate evidence? Why do we have confidence when I say, you know, that there are no biological races within the human species? Why am I 1,000% confident of that? I'm going to tell you, demonstrate that in short order. So, let's start with, you know, the classics of the neo-Darwinian synthesis. For those of you who are biology majors, if you haven't read Ernst Mayr's Population, Species, and Evolution, that was the book that I learned evolution on when I was a sophomore at Oberlin College, okay? And so, this is what Mayr says, okay? One of these architects of this great neo-Darwinian synthesis. Mayr noted that the term subspecies, which was equivalent to geographical race, had come into common usage in the 19th century, replacing the notion of the variety. The variety came from Christian theology in the 17th century. So this is what he said. The concept of subspecies is fallacious. Species are not composites of uniform subtypes, subspecies, but consist of an almost infinite number of local populations. Each in turn, in sexual species, consisting of genetically different individuals. The difficulties of the subspecies concept are intensified if one considers the subspecies not merely a practical device of the taxonomist, but also as a unit of evolution. The better the geographical variation of the species is known, the more difficult it becomes to delimit subspecies, and the more obvious it becomes that many such delimitations are quite arbitrary. In other words, no biological basis, no acceptable, repeatable criteria. It really comes down to, you know, hey, yeah, let's call it this, let's call it that, blah, 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 blah. Okay? Now, so you may have difficulty accepting this scientific fact. I'm going to state it as a scientific fact, but it's another lecture for another day. Okay? For those of you who are unaware, all people on this planet who are alive today are descended from a small group of people who first evolved in Africa around 300,000 years ago. Okay? It's called the Out of Africa Theory of Human Evolution. I have a chapter in a new book on science and religion called Out of Africa, and you can read that chapter where I give all of the voluminous evidence demonstrating that all anatomically modern humans first evolved in Africa. Now, we know this because there is a direct relationship between the genetic diversity in populations as measured by the term heterozygosity. Now, I know not everyone in this audience has taken genetics, but a heterozygous person is a person who has one copy of a gene from their mother and one copy of a gene from their father, biological father, and those two copies are different from each other. If they're the same, we call those people homozygous. If they're different, we call them heterozygous. Heterozygosity increases with the genetic variability of the population. So the first humans on this planet lived in Africa, and all humans on this planet lived there for 200,000 years before anybody left Africa. That is why Africa has more genetic variability than all of the rest of the world combined, because the mutation rate in eukaryotic organisms like ourselves is constant. So the more time that passes, the more mutations that accumulate. As you move away from Africa to the Middle East, to Europe, to Central Asia, to East Asia, to Oceania and the Americas, the genetic diversity of human beings declines linearly. Okay? That is because as populations move, they lose genetic diversity by random chance, what we call genetic drift. So most of the genetic variability in the world, by the way, is due to random chance. Just blind, dumb luck associated with the migratory pattern of humans out of Africa over the last 100,000 years. Now, just to get this straight, we're not talking about a whole lot of genetic variability here. Any two people in this audience share, by chance alone, 99.9% of their genome in common. So we're talking about 0.1% of your genome differentiates you as an individual. Now, here's another thing that's going to blow your mind. If I choose two people at random from Africa, living in Africa now, and one African and one European at random, which pair do you think is closer in their genome? The two Africans or the African and the European? Somebody said African and European, and they would be right. And the reason for that is because there's more genetic variability in Africa than all of the rest of the world combined. So an African and European drawn at random are closer to each other genetically than two Africans drawn at random, as shown by this data. And there's also additional data that demonstrates out of Africa, mitochondrial DNA phylogenies, Y chromosome phylogenies, fossils of human beings in Africa, linkage disequilibrium, okay, which shows a clear pattern of out of Africa. Again, read that chapter because that's another lecture for another day. Now, during that migration, there was some adaptation. So it wasn't like people just moved and nothing happened. But the things that happened are the things that you would sort of think should happen. And none of this is mysterious. So for example, in the movement of human beings and the domestication of animals, stuff happened. Like people who domesticated cows accumulated mutations that allowed their lactase gene to stay operational past weaning. The default condition for mammals once their young are weaned is for lactase enzyme to turn off. Why would you have an enzyme turned on that's not doing anything? So when people domesticated cows and started drinking their milk, there was now a benefit to keeping your lactase enzyme turned on. Well, guess what? That didn't just happen in Northern Europe. So if you look at the slide, you see the cow up there in Scandinavia. But it happened in the Middle East. It happened in East Africa too. So if you go on YouTube and you see these white supremacists chugging milk as a sign of Aryan supremacy, it's not. The lactase enzyme, you know, happened wherever people domesticated cows. Okay, what about things like malaria? Malaria transmission begins when humans domesticate animals. Mosquitoes feed on the cattle, then start feeding on the people and transmitting malaria. Well, everywhere there is malaria, there are malarial adaptations. And there's like five or six of them noticed there. But that's in Africa, it's in Southern Europe, it's in Sicily, it's in Italy, it's in Greece, it's in Saudi Arabia, it's in India, it's in Southeast Asia. So malaria adaptations like HBS, hemoglobin S, does not define people as biological races, because wherever there's malaria, there's HBS, or thalassemia, or ovale cystis. Okay, and so malaria doesn't discriminate by geographical location of people. What about altitude? People who live at high altitude have high altitude adaptations. So in the Kenyan Rift Valley, you see examples of high altitude adaptation. You also see it in the Himalayas. You also see it in the Andes. Okay, skin color variation is associated with solar intensity. So how many of you saw the article in the New York Times last week with an artist's rendition of a European living in Europe around 32,000 years ago? Guess what? His skin color was the same as mine. Now, how do we know that? Because ancient DNA, paleogenomics, we sequence these bones and the DNA in them. We find the genetic variants associated with skin color, particularly in the SLC24A5 gene. And guess what? They have the African gene. Okay, you don't start seeing light skin color phenotypes in Europe until about 10,000 years ago. The blonde hair gene is only about 6,000 years. Blue eye gene is only about 6,000 years. So for the vast majority of the time in which our species existed on this planet, nobody had blonde hair, nobody had blue skies, nobody blue eyes, nobody had fair skin. You're talking about 6,000, 10,000 years out of 300,000. So, yes, there has been some adaptation around the world, but guess what traits we do not find evidence for strong adaptation for? Every one of the traits you see up there, and this paper was published in Science in 2016, those are single Mendelian genes, single genetic loci. Only once do we see a strong example of a polygenic trait, and that's height in Northern Europe. So guess what else are polygenic traits for which we see no evidence of differential adaptation for? Intelligence, personality, are polygenic traits. We have absolutely no evidence of strong selection for differences in intelligence. And so when people ask me this question, well, Dr. Graves, you know, you say that, you know, there has been no selection for intelligence. What I say is, yeah, it happened 300,000 years ago when we became humans in Africa. And we became problem-solving intelligent hominids. And as we moved around the world, we continued to solve problems. There's no environment on Earth that doesn't present problems for people when they're moving there. There was this one crazily stupid theory called the winter selection theory. Somehow, people in Eurasia were smarter than Africans because winter was harder to adapt to than living in the tropics. Are you kidding me? I mean, that's the kind of stuff people just make up because they want to have a reason for why they're genetically superior. Oh yeah, it was winter. It was cold. If winter was the issue, why the hell did you leave Africa? That seems to be rather stupid, don't you think? So, and if there were such evidence, with modern whole genome sequencing, we would see it. And when we look at genes that have been associated with intellectual cognitive performance, as I discuss in chapter 9 in the book, there's absolutely no evidence of that. So you probably heard of this geneticist, David Reich at Harvard, who wrote Who We Are and How We Got Here. So bad boy, you know, in 2016, I was asked by Harvard University to give the 150th anniversary speech for the Peabody Museum of Ethnography and Archaeology. And this is Harvard, right? This is not milquetoast school in the middle of nowhere. They could ask anybody in the world to give that inaugural speech for the Peabody Museum. They asked me. I talk about how ridiculous it is for people to think that there was natural selection making some people smarter than others. Reich's in the audience. He could have asked me a question from the audience, like all of you will have the opportunity to do when this is over. He didn't say a word. Next thing I know, he's got a piece, opinion piece in the New York Times saying all sorts of crazy, ridiculous stuff, which I replied to. Next thing I know, his book is out, and he's got my name in his last chapter. Graves says that there's, you know, no selection for intelligence. Boy, is he wrong. I'm like, will you excuse me for a minute? I spent my entire career doing experiments on selection on quantitative traits. You don't do that kind of work. Who are you to start making up stuff about what I do and do not know in genetics? And there's absolutely no evidence for what you say. Whole lot of evidence for what I say. And there's that picture. So here you have an artist's rendering of a person belonging to the Vestanese people who lived in Italy 30,000 to 24,000 years ago. The DNA from these people lack the mutations that produce pale skin. Okay? So, now that you have some science about human variation, let's go back into the days of pseudoscience. Okay? So, here are some 19th century beliefs. And this is a time when polygenism was the natural science of the world. Polygenism was the idea that God created separate Adam and Eves. Okay, so this is the pre-Adamite race theory. And the Europeans were the ones that were descended from the Adam and Eve that are in the Bible. All the dark-skinned people are descended from some, you know, John Doe, Adam and Eves that were just sort of created. So, 1799, physicians felt Africans and Europeans generally suffered from the same diseases and disabilities. However, some were unique to Africans. So, in that same year, William Harvey and John Lindsay defined the disease cachexia africana, or dirt eating, which was associated with emotional distress and depression. Now it turns out that there is a condition known as dirt eating. And it was something that people did when they were low in iron. And so by eating dirt, they increased the iron content of their blood. So it was a rational thing to do. And it's not like, you know, enslaved people being made to work from dark to dark might not have iron deficiencies. I mean, after all. Tidemans, 1826, darker skin allowed Africans to withstand heat and humid conditions better than Europeans. That is true. Darker skin evolved in the tropics, and it does help with that. Samuel Cartwright, in 1850, one of America's leading physicians, came up with the idea that Negro consumption, which is tuberculosis, was somehow different from white consumption. Now, there were reasons why there were differential numbers of enslaved people with, what's the disease? I just said it. Consumption, but actually it's tuberculosis, what I was looking for. And again, being enslaved, not having a proper diet, being worked to death, that it tended to make you more likely to come down with infectious disease. But these two are his most well-known disease inventions. Drapetomania, or the irrational desire of Negroes to run away from slavery. After all, I mean, why would anyone want to be free? Right? Why would anyone want to keep their family together? Why would anyone not to want to see their children being worked and whipped? I mean, totally irrational. And dysthesia, a disease that caused slaves to perform tasks in a haphazard manner. In other words, why would anyone who is not being paid for their labor, right, want to slow down and not work themselves to death? Okay, so, but in the 21st century, We had physicians thinking the same sort of crazy stuff. Here's Sally Seitel, a member of the American Enterprise Institute, a leading conservative think tank, saying to the New York Times, "In practicing medicine, I am not colorblind. I always take note of my patient's race. So do many of my colleagues. We do it because certain diseases and treatment responses cluster by ethnicity." Now, you've already now seen the problem in her claim. First, she says she's taking account of race, which is something that I pointed out, socially defined race is arbitrarily put together, but might have something to do with biological variation. But then she says diseases and treatment responses cluster by ethnicity. Ethnicity is not a biological term. Ethnicity is a cultural, anthropological, sociological term. So she can't even get her term straight in her sentence. Now, in 2016, a group of researchers at the University of Virginia's Law School, which is one of America's premier medical schools, did a survey of their first, second, third year medical students and residents for false beliefs in human biological variation associated with medicine. First, blacks age more slowly than whites. 33.3% of their first years thought that. 38.9% of their second years thought that. By the third year, it had dropped 20.3%. But 50% of their residents thought that. Now, that's in part because those residents come to the University of Virginia from other medical programs, not theirs. Black nerve endings less sensitive than white, 12.7, 19.4. Luckily, the University of Virginia, by their third year, had dismissed that myth. But again, 14.3% of their residents. Now, what is the implications of people believing things like this? It's been shown that physicians are less willing to prescribe pain medication to people who are considered black because they believe that they can withstand pain more than people who are considered white. Black blood coagulates more quickly than whites, 46.0, 23.36. Again, by their third year, they had dropped it to 5.1, but again, 14.3% of their residents. Black skin is thicker than white, 63.5, 58.3, 37.3, 100% of their residents. Okay, blacks have stronger immune systems than whites. 33.3, 20.8, 5.1, again, dropped by the time. And this paper was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and this is only 7 years ago. Now, from the Grand Round lectures that I have been doing with Andrea around the country in the last 2 or 3 years, these beliefs are still rampant in American medical schools. Racial medicine is still rampant in medical textbooks. Now, I was just a consultant for Elsevier's Robinson Kumar's Basic Pathology, 11th edition. We removed a lot of the racial medicine in that, but we didn't get it all. But that's only one textbook. The American Academy of Pediatricians have now come out with a statement against racial medicine, but they only did that after Andrea and I published a paper in academic medicine showing that their textbook was rife with racial mistakes. A month later, miraculously, they come out with a statement, "We're now against racial medicine." Where were you over the 21st century? So now, one of the problems, of course, that leads to these racist and racial ideas in medicine is that these 19th century typological beliefs are embedded in biomedical research and clinical practice. So again, since everybody here is not a biologist, typology is a notion that things are just mere expressions of a perfect eternal ideas. Typology goes back to the Greek philosopher Plato, okay, in which you think, oh, black, they're black. And there's an essence of blackness. White, they're white, and there's an essence of whiteness, and so on. These typological beliefs are what medical professionals are being trained in, and this is what they're doing. Now, To show you that that's absolutely wrong, particularly in the case of the United States, let's look at the genetic ancestry of persons who are socially defined as African American. So, what you see here are the results of a paper that was done by by 23andMe, using Illumina version 1, version 2 panels, in which they looked at 950,000 single nucleotide polymorphisms, that is, pieces of the DNA where different bases can be found, A, T, C, or G. Now, the human genome is 3.3 billion base pairs long. So 950,000 is a small number compared to 3.3 billion, which is the total length of the genome. But anyway, when you do this, you find that African Americans, on average, are 16% European in their ancestry. That's the average. But there's population subdivision. In other words, it differs by state and region of the United States. For example, in South Carolina, the percentage is very, very low. But in West Virginia, it's in excess of 30% European ancestry. Same in Washington State, 25 to 30%. Kansas, 25 to 30%. So it differs depending upon the state, and that, of course, has to do with American history. Okay? Now, where did this European ancestry enter African Americans? It didn't happen in the 20th century. Okay? It happened during chattel slavery. Now, how do we know this? Well, there's the voluminous historical narrative, 12 years a slave, and so on. But you could say, as laws are being passed across the United States right now, okay, well, we don't read 12 years a slave anymore because that's divisive. Okay? Those people just made that stuff up. Okay? So let's let them have that for one second. Scientifically, we know that this was European men impregnating African women. How do we know this? Y chromosomes are passed unaltered from father to son. So you can determine where a Y chromosome came into existence on the earth. Guess what? Between 16 to 25% of African American male Y chromosomes are European. This is how we know Thomas Jefferson fathered Estes Hemings. That paper was published in Nature because Estes Hemings carried a Jefferson Y chromosome. And of course they argued, no, it was Jefferson's brother. Okay, yeah. So Jefferson's brother showed up 5 times and made Sally Hemings pregnant 5 times. Yeah, sure. You want to accept that narrative. But we know that that Y chromosome was European. Also, African American mitochondrial DNAs are African. Mitochondrial DNA is passed from mother to daughter. And by the way, it's not just African Americans. It's Afro-Brazilians, it's Afro-Canadians, it's Afro-English, it's Afro-French, and Afro-Caribbeans. So they're all showing the same pattern of mitochondrial African DNA and European Y chromosomes, which matches the historical narrative. So you can try to outlaw the historical narrative, which they are trying to do, but they're going to have a hard time outlawing the science. Now, since I know I'm running late and I'm not even close to the end of this talk, so I'm going to try to skip some stuff and get us to the end. So, and this has happened with the Latin American populations as well. So, for example, if you look at people from Puerto Rico, they are on average 72% European, 12% African, and 16% Amerindian. But Mexican Americans are 51% Amerindians, 46% European, and only about 3% African. In Colombia, the national average is 64, 29, 7. In Peru, it's 80% Amerindian, 18% European, and 2% African. But in Peru, there are Afro-Peruvians who are 80% African. Okay? And similarly, when we go to Colombia, if you go to the regional capital of Medellin, their genetic ancestry looks like the national average. But if you go to the neighboring state of Chocó, which was a site of plantation agriculture and saw the importation of large numbers of enslaved Africans, then you see a ancestry profile very much like that of African Americans, 80% African, but a much higher percent of Native American genetic ancestry. So, humans do not have biological races, but, okay, factors in biology do determine health, okay? So, for example, what you're looking at here are data from 2019, actually these are 2015 data, showing heart disease, cancer, by ratio, by socially defined race. So this is a ratio, this is a mortality ratio across age. And what you can see is that African Americans are dying more from heart disease and cancer than European Americans are. If the rates were equal, you would see that dotted black line at 1.0. But we don't see that. The same thing is true of influenza, of septicemia, okay? 2.5 times. So if this isn't due to genetic differences, what is causing this? So, this results from quantitative genetics, which again is probably above the scope of folks in here, but I'm gonna try to make it as simple as I can. So the variance in any physical trait is determined by contributions from genes, V sub G, from the environment, V sub E, from gene by environment interaction, meaning genes act differently in different environments, plus the covariance of genes at environment, meaning that sometimes a gene will be differentially associated with a good environment, and sometimes that gene will be differentially associated with a bad environment. If you don't know about the statistical association, then you'll say, oh, there's a good gene and there's a bad gene. No, it's actually one gene is found in a bad place and the other gene is found in the good place. Now, what we know about these physical traits is that we see large differences in health profiles. The genetic effect is in fact quite small. The environmental effect is large. The gene by environment effect is large. The covariance effect is large. And the error term is unknown depending upon what you're measuring. So in other words, human beings can be really similar genetically, but because of the different environments that they live in, and here I mean structural racism, you have different health outcomes. Now, to show you that it shouldn't be that way, we've actually looked at probable and possible bad genetic variants in African Americans and European Americans. So, if you look at genetic variants in the African American genome that are possibly bad, and compare those to those in the European American genome that are possibly bad, there's no statistical difference. That's the panel on the left. But if you look at the ones that are probably bad, European Americans have a statistically significantly higher number of probably bad genetic variants compared to African Americans. Now this is in part because of that migration out of Africa and the loss of genes by genetic drift. So in other words, if we had a simply genetic explanation for health disparity, it should be African Americans who are the most healthy people in this country, and it should be European Americans who have the most sickness. But in fact, we see the exact opposite pattern. So, and when we measure the inheritance of lifespan, heritability speaks to whether offspring resemble their parents in a physical trait. European Americans have the highest heritability, which means the biggest genetic component to lifespan, but Caribbean Hispanics in New York City, African Americans in New York City in this study had the lowest. And what that means is that because of the conditions of society, European Americans are living closest to their expected genetic lifespan, whereas Caribbean Hispanics and African Americans are living much further away from their expected genetic lifespan. Now, how well is that? Well, the best study of lifespan in the world had a heritability of 0.333. So European Americans in New York in this time period were doing really well. And now again, to show that this isn't genetic, these studies that I've listed below here demonstrate that when people from African nations come to the United States, within one generation, their progeny take on the health profile of African Americans. These were not problems when they lived in Africa. They become problems when they come to America, okay? So, causes of these disparities are twofold. Those that are intrinsic to the genome, selective advantage, which I showed at the beginning of this lecture. There are things that occur due to population bottlenecks, such, for example, the high frequency of the BRCA breast cancer 1, breast cancer 2 mutations in Ashkenazim of Eastern Europe is due to the Holocaust. Before the Holocaust, that wasn't a problem. After the Holocaust, it was. That's a population bottleneck. There's also inbreeding for religious caste and geographical regions. So there are a lot of diseases that are found in Mormons in Utah because of their inbreeding with the same group of people. In fact, some of the best human genetics research hospitals in the world are in Utah because of their history of inbreeding. Now, but yet, Richard Cooper et al. Say, central observations remain. Variation is continuous and discordant with race. Systematic variation according to continent is very limited, and there is no evidence that the units of interest for medical genetics correspond to what we call races. Okay, this is another example showing that African women living in Africa show the same birth weight profile as European American women. Their birth rate profile drops when they move to the United States. Okay, again, that's more disparity stuff, which you probably know about, so I'm going to try to bring us to the end of this lecture. So, when we look about how racism works, okay, people often think about individual, personal acts of racism. And too much of the focus on racism has been on individual, personal acts. But in fact, the things that are causing the health disparities that we observe in society are not individual personal acts. They're institutional acts, okay? And cultural beliefs and norms, okay? Okay, so that's really not that important, so I'm gonna end with this new report that just came out from the National Academies of Science, literally on the 14th of March. Using population descriptors in genetics and genomics research, note on the first page of the report who they quote. Our social conceptions of race and ethnicity do not match the underlying biological and genetic variation within our species, and we should never confuse the things that were created for the purposes of oppressing people with the nature of that biological and genetic variation. So I invite you to read the report from the Select Committee of the National Academy of Sciences, dismantling these false ideas of biological race within our species and underscoring how structures of institutional racism are still killing people as we speak. So I thank you for your attention to my talk, and I am happy to answer any questions that you might have, which I'm sure will be numerous.